Hey everyone, I'm Thanos Davelis, and welcome back to The Greek Current, a podcast by the Hellenic American Leadership Council and Kathy Merini, where we highlight the top stories of the day every afternoon with analysis from guest experts, policymakers, journalists, and HELC staff. U.S.-Turkey tensions flared following the death of 13 Turkish soldiers, police, and civilians who perished during an offensive against PKK Kurdish militants in Iraqi Kurdistan. Turkish President Erdogan slammed the U.S. State Department's initial condemnation of the deaths before Secretary of State Antony Blinken delivered a swift clarification during his call with Foreign Minister Cavusoglu on Monday. The death toll and the manner in which the men were killed has also impacted Turkish domestic politics. Dr. Aykan Erdemir, the director of the Turkey Program at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies and a former Turkish lawmaker, joins us to analyze these developments. Aykan, welcome back.
It's a pleasure to join you again.
So what can you tell us about this latest fallout, if we can call it that, between the United States and Turkey?
Now, to begin with, this has been one of the most embarrassing operational failures and intelligence failures in Turkish political history. But Erdogan does not seem ready to take responsibility. Neither Erdogan nor Turkey's defense minister, who was, you know, instrumental in putting this operation together, seem to be open for accountability. Instead, they have started the blame game. So externally, they have started pointing the finger to the United States, blaming Washington for supporting terrorism. And at home, they have pointed the finger to Turkey's opposition bloc, criminalizing them en masse, and again, claiming that Turkey's opposition has been supporting terrorism. And this, of course, is, you know, one of the oldest tricks in the book. When you have a massive failure, deflect blame by finding scapegoats. And we know that Erdogan excels at this game.
How did this play out between the United States and Turkey? I know we saw State Department issue a condemnation that Erdogan wasn't too happy about, and then Secretary Blinken walked it back. How did this play out?
So let's start by stating the facts, so our audience can also decide for their own. Now, the United States was the first country, as far as I could tell, to reach out by offering condolences to Turkey and also by condemning the PKK's terrorism. It's also important to remember that the United States designated the PKK as a terrorist entity all the way back in 1997 when it started designating foreign terrorist organizations. And it's also important to remember that the United States has consistently offered military and intelligence support for Turkey's counterterrorism operations. In fact, in 1999, it was U.S. intelligence that led to Ankara's capture of PKK leader Abdullah Öcalan in Kenya. So at this point, Erdogan manages to basically erase all these facts and reframe this entire failed operation as an American fault. And they're just referring to, you know, two words in the U.S. State Department statement, which is, if confirmed, to reframe this whole debate around U.S. support for terrorism. And I think that neither fits into the proper framework of alliance within NATO, nor it's very, let's say, sincere in terms of communicating.
For our listeners, the statement that the State Department issued was, quote, if the reports of the death of Turkish civilians at the hands of the PKK, a designated terrorist organization, are confirmed, we condemn this action in the strongest possible terms. Why did the State Department use, you know, the term if here?
I think that is a reflection of the level of distrust between Washington and Ankara. Again, you might remember that over the last several years, there have been multiple times in which the State Department or the White House had to issue statements refuting earlier statements by Ankara about bilateral talks. So this is as embarrassing as it gets in bilateral relations, right? When you have two presidents meeting or when you have two, you know, foreign ministers meeting, and then they both issue readouts about that meeting. And it's, you know, quite unheard of for Washington to repeatedly refute statements coming from Ankara saying that the readouts don't reflect accurately what was exchanged during this bilateral meeting. So I think given how unreliable reports from Ankara lately have been, I think the State Department just wanted to be on the safe side by adding that statement, you know, if confirmed. I think one could argue that diplomatically that was a risky statement, but I don't think that that statement alone should be legitimate grounds for all the escalation that the Erdogan government has been responsible for since then.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken issued a clarification during a call with Turkey's Foreign Minister Mevlüt Çavuşoğlu this week. Can you talk about that?
I think it was immediately clear to Washington that how the Erdogan government was exploiting this conversation or this statement. And Secretary of State Blinken, I think, made sure through an unequivocal statement what the U.S. position is on the issue. And of course, I think that fits the overall U.S. position vis-a-vis the PKK. Because as I mentioned before, I think since Washington designated the PKK as a terrorist organization in 1997, the U.S. has never been equivocal about PKK terrorism and has always condemned attacks and offered condolences, unlike many other countries in the region.
Erdogan has frequently bashed the United States over its partnership with the Syrian Kurds, for example. At the same time, however, it doesn't call out Russia, which hasn't designated the PKK as a terror group at all. Is this a double standard here that we see from Ankara?
Yes, that is indeed a very interesting double standard, because Russia has not designated the PKK, and often Russian military equipment end up in PKK's hands. Similarly, Iran has a long history of providing logistical and military aid to the PKK. You know, the relationship has its ups and downs. But you rarely hear from Ankara, especially, you know, under the Erdogan government, any criticism targeting Russia or Iran. So then, you know, this begs the question, why is the Erdogan government, you know, constantly targeting the United States, but not Russia and Iran, two key adversaries of NATO?
Aykan, you mentioned earlier that this was an example of an operation gone wrong on the part of Turkey in Iraqi Kurdistan. And we've seen Turkey's opposition parties question why the government failed to negotiate the men's release and instead risked a military operation in the first place. How is this news impacting internal Turkish politics today?
Now, there are, I think, two different dynamics at work. One is, of course, the chilling effect that the Turkish government has used this traumatic event to basically criminalize any discussion about the Kurdish issue. And to my surprise, and to the credit of Turkey's resilient opposition, I don't see people backing down, meaning Turkey's opposition parties, as well as, you know, NGOs, have been asking the hard questions about the mistakes made in planning and carrying out this operation. But more importantly, I think the main criticism has been why such an operation, which was extremely risky, especially carried out during, you know, these difficult winter months, was necessary at this time. And I think the answer that most interlocutors give here is that Erdogan, who was really cornered not only by the economic crisis, but also growing isolation in foreign policy, needed a big win. And unfortunately, the big win that he looked for didn't come. It ended in horrible human cost. And now, of course, he's still trying to turn this into an advantage to basically strengthen his iron-fisted rule in Turkey.
Speaking of using this as an advantage, is this why we're now seeing a renewed crackdown on members of the pro-Kurdish People's Democratic Party, or the HDP?
Definitely. Not only Erdogan, but his ultra-nationalist partners in the MHP, the Nationalist Action Party, have used this opportunity to increase pressure on Turkey's second largest opposition party, the HDP, namely the People's Democratic Party. In fact, Turkey's ultra-nationalists have long been calling for banning the pro-Kurdish party. And to be frank, that's quite a credible threat, because Turkey has had a long list of pro-Kurdish parties banned since the 1990s. But if history is any guide, every time a party was banned, a new party was established, and every single time the new party received more support than the previous party that was banned. So, you know, if history is any guide, I think ultra-nationalists should stay away from banning political parties because it only makes the opposition stronger.
Turkish President Erdogan vowed to expand cross-border operations against Kurdish militants in northern Iraq following the killing of these 13 soldiers, police, and civilians. He even mentioned a safe zone across Turkey and Iraq's borders. What kind of moves do you anticipate Turkey will take in this region now?
Turkey already has a significant military presence in northern Iraq, especially within the territories of Iraqi Kurdistan, you know, governed by Kurdistan regional government. And this continues to be a problem not only between Ankara and Erbil, but also between Ankara and Baghdad. Because over the last few years, we have seen quite a number of protest statements issued by the Iraqi Foreign Ministry. And although the Iraqi Kurdistan government has been, let's say, quite diplomatic in trying to deal with Ankara, I think it's also quite well known that they are also uneasy about Turkey's growing footprint in the region. Especially over the last year, there has been numerous collateral killing of Iraqi civilians, you know, Kurds in northern Iraq during Turkey's military operations and, you know, Turkish jet strikes. And of course, this is putting both governments in Erbil and Baghdad under increasing voter pressure. And if Erdogan does indeed intensify Turkish presence and cross-border operations, I think the fair assumption would be that this will further strain relations between Ankara and Erbil, as well as between Ankara and Baghdad.
Aykan, thanks for joining us again on The Greek Current.
Thank you for having me.
In other news, heavy snowfall blanketed the Acropolis and other ancient monuments in Athens, caused power cuts, and halted COVID-19 vaccinations in the Greek capital on Tuesday as the weather brought many services across the country to a standstill. Greek media reported that 3 deaths in separate parts of the country were linked with the bad weather. Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis met with emergency response leaders to assist residents in blacked-out areas and villages cut off by the snow. "We obviously recommend great care be taken in all movement. All unnecessary movement should be avoided," Mitsotakis said after the meeting, adding that authorities were doing everything they could to keep the roads open and to restore power to areas without electricity. Finally, accords between Greece, Cyprus, and Israel allowing citizens with COVID-19 vaccination certificates to travel between the 3 countries have been hailed as a possible first step towards normalizing tourism during the next phase of the pandemic. Last week, Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis visited Israel and signed such an agreement with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. On Sunday, Cypriot President Nikos Anastasiades flew to Israel to strike the same deal. Under the accords, Israeli citizens who can prove they've received an EU-approved COVID-19 vaccination will not have to undergo PCR tests or self-isolate upon arrival in either Greece or Cyprus once travel resumes. Anastasiades said that the resumption of unrestricted free movement is of great importance to Cyprus, which is a tourism-dependent country. That wraps up today's episode of The Greek Current. Thanks for tuning in.